there would have been a span of time between the last photos and the ultimate conclusion, and those we'll never know what happened in that time frame.
A fatal bear attack in Denali National Park. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new record low in Arctic sea ice loss.
Now it's become kind of like crushed ice, and that's a lot easier to melt and melt more quickly. It's almost like at least parts of the Arctic have become like a giant slushy.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. And by the Federal Aviation Administration, setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports. FAA.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704.
This weekend marked a tragic first for Denali National Park. On Friday, three hikers near Toklat Road Camp made a discovery that would lead to the first bear mauling fatality in the park's history. From Talkeetna, KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
The group of hikers discovered an abandoned backpack along the Toklat River and upon further investigation found evidence of a violent struggle. The hikers immediately returned to the Toklat campground and reported their findings to Park Service at approximately 5:30 p.m. Park rangers then launched a helicopter and fixed-wing aircraft to search the area where the unsettling evidence had been discovered. Approximately 30 minutes after beginning the search, the helicopter team made the discovery of the remains that would later be identified to be those of Richard White, 49 years old, of San Diego, California. Denali National Park spokesperson Maureen McLaughlin says they identified a bear guarding a cache and feeding on remains, but that the bear retreated when the helicopter approached. The bear soon reapproached the rangers and began circling, forcing them to retreat to the gravel bar and fire a rifle into the air to force the bear to retreat before boarding the helicopter again. Due to waning light and the presence of at least one bear, further investigation was delayed until Saturday. Rangers and Alaska State Troopers returned to the scene on Saturday, where a large male grizzly was defending the site of White's remains and preventing the recovery team from approaching. McLaughlin says the park has a bear-human conflict management plan to determine whether the bear should be killed.
In this case, the bear was aggressive. It was threatening to both rangers and troopers that were out at the site, and it was very defensively defending its cache site, so the kill. And according to the plan, when we have a case of predation like this, with a visitor getting killed and human consumption also being part of it, it results in destroying the bear.
Photographs from White's camera show the first part of the interaction, where White took several pictures of a bear that was unaware of him. The last photos of the camera show the bear becoming aware of the backpacker, according to McLaughlin.
The bear was not showing signs of aggression in those photos, or no obvious signs of aggression, but there was a point in time where the bear became aware of the backpacker. And so there's just, you know, one or two photos where that is evident, and the camera was put down at that point. But there's, you know, there would have been a span of time between the last photos and the ultimate conclusion, and those we'll never know what happened in that time frame.
The attack occurred in Unit 10, or the West Branch Upper Toklat area of Denali National Park. The area is frequented by hikers due to its proximity to the park road and its access to glacial headwaters. The area has been closed until the investigation into the fatal mauling has concluded. As of Saturday night, 12 additional hiking parties had been cleared from the area, and no additional incidents have been reported. Before being allowed to hike into the backcountry, hikers are required to undergo what McLaughlin described as one of the most extensive bear awareness programs in the national park system. The briefing advises hikers to maintain at least 1/4 mile of distance between themselves and any bear. White had obtained a permit to hike in the backcountry and so was required to undergo the bear awareness program. Richard White's remains were recovered and sent to the office of the medical examiner in Anchorage. The bear's remains were taken by Park Service to conduct a necropsy. Details as to the cause of the attack are still unclear, and rangers are continuing their investigation. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
The sea ice in the Arctic has melted back to a new record. Officials with the National Snow and Ice Data Center said yesterday their satellite could see even less ice than it saw in September of 2007. At a news teleconference today, senior scientist Claire Parkinson of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration's Goddard Space Flight Center said the sea ice withdrawal this year is even more surprising than the one in 2007.
That was a gigantic decrease from previous years. All of us who had been working on sea ice studies for a long time were just stunned at how much of a decrease that was. Fortunately, in the subsequent couple of years, it went up a little bit. However, this year, it's plummeting.
The reason for the abrupt decline this summer is an uncommonly big storm that blew into the Arctic from the coast of Alaska on August 5th. The next day, a huge low-pressure area was centered over the North Pole, and the storm simply ripped up the sea ice, most of which had formed the winter before. Research scientist Walt Meyer says the effect of the storm would not have been so dramatic had the ice been thicker.
It used to be the Arctic ice cover was kind of like a big block of ice. It would melt a little bit from the edges, but it was pretty solid. And now it's become kind of like crushed ice. And that's a lot easier to melt and melt more quickly. It's almost like at least parts of the Arctic have become like a giant slushy.
The prior record for sea ice pullback of 1.61 square miles was set in late September of 2007. Now it has been broken in late August. It is already down to 1.58 million square miles. That's a little more than 4 million square kilometers. The scientists say they can't really speculate with any degree of certainty on how much more melting there will be.
If it doesn't start freezing up until late September, the decrease could be much more substantial. As I said, the plot would suggest it could go down below the 3 million square kilometer level.
But already the Arctic is cooling as the days get shorter and the sunlight falls less directly.
It's certainly refreezing up at the North Pole in the very high Arctic, but we're still losing lots of ice down at the ice edge further south.
Up until now, scientists have been guessing that an ice-free summer Arctic Ocean was 50 years away. They are now moving that estimate up to perhaps 30 years. The disappearance of sea ice in the Arctic could be a relief for at least one group. Shell is using new ice forecasts to petition the federal government for a longer drilling season in the Beaufort Sea. A Shell spokesperson told Bloomberg News today that the company believes it can safely tack on 2 weeks in the Beaufort Sea. They need that time because the drilling season is already almost over. There's only a month left to drill in the Chukchi and 2 months left in the Beaufort. Shell's Arctic drilling expedition has been plagued by delays and public mishaps this summer, but they are making progress. In the last week, both of Shell's drill ships departed Unalaska for the Arctic. The Noble Discoverer drill rig, which made headlines when it dragged anchor and almost went aground on Airport Beach in June, left on Saturday morning. It's bound for the Chukchi Sea. The Kuluk drill ship is now halfway to the Beaufort Sea. But Shell can't start drilling until its oil spill response barge is on hand in the Arctic. That ship has to be Coast Guard certified before it can head north. To get the most out of this drilling season, Shell is asking the federal government for more flexibility on the kinds of wells it can drill. Shell has asked the Interior Department to let them drill part of their test wells before the barge gets there. The company wouldn't be able to reach hydrocarbon deposits, but the drilling would lay the groundwork for the first test wells of the 2013 season. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a near riot in an Anchorage park that went unreported in July.
People were coming and joining the fracas, and so soon the size of the crowd got way bigger. I've been told perhaps from 25 to 50 people.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Era Alaska. For more than 30 years, Era Alaska has been transporting packages across the state. Business documents, medical supplies, even family pets. More details at flyera.com or talk to your local Era Alaska agent. Era Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. A PFD reminder, check the status of your 2012 PFD application with My PFD Info online at pfd.alaska.gov. You can view or change your voluntary deductions until Friday, August 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Ballot Measure 2 on Tuesday's primary election ballot is the most hotly contested initiative Alaska voters have faced in recent memory. In the last 5 years, only the 2008 Clean Water Initiative, aimed at stopping development of the proposed Pebble Mine, had more spending for and against. As with that initiative, industry groups are lining up against Measure 2, outspending proponents by more than 7-1. If approved, Measure 2 would restore the Alaska Coastal Management Program, a federally funded state agency that operated smoothly and with little fanfare for more than 30 years before legislators and the Parnell administration failed to reach a deal to reauthorize it in 2011. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
If Measure 2 opponents are to be believed, coastal management is actually a good thing. The one-time head of the state's coastal management review process, Kurt Fredrickson, is now the public face of the Vote No on 2 campaign.
Whether it's called coastal management or some other form, clearly I believe Alaska needs a stronger voice in federal decision-making. They're a dominant force in Alaska, and we have to have a stronger voice. And the decisions they make, whether it's to protect or develop Alaska's resources.
But speaking to the Juneau Chamber of Commerce in June, Fredrickson said Measure 2 would be a step backward for the state. The Alaska Coastal Management Program changed significantly during the Frank Murkowski administration. Some say it was gutted, others say reformed. Fredrickson, who also served as Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner under Murkowski, falls into the latter category.
In the previous coastal management program, which existed for 35 years, there were lots of debates over the years, and those debates got resolved. They got settled, and they got reflected in the law. We're going back to a time when those debates are going to just kind of come up again.
He thinks that will lead to lawsuits, confusion, and project delays. But ballot measure 2 supporters say those are exactly the kind of things the initiative would help avoid. It restores the Coastal Management Program's coordinated review process, which streamlines the coastal development permitting activities of various local, state, and federal agencies. The Alaska Sea Party sponsored Measure 2. At a recent news conference, Sea Party co-chair Terza Tippin-Poe gave an example of the regulatory morass developers face without coastal management.
Say it's a dock. You're going to have to take that project proposal and the list of permits that you need for that project, and you're going to have to go to the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Environmental Conservation, Fish and Game, Corps of Engineers, and walk that from agency to agency.
That may not be a big deal to large corporations, but Poe says it hurts small businesses and individuals. Measure 2 also would reestablish an Alaska Coastal Policy Board, part of the program scrapped by Murkowski. The board would be comprised of 4 state commissioners and 9 public members to be nominated by local communities and appointed by the governor. The board would review district management plans developed by coastal communities to ensure they comply with state regulations. Poe says it would not have veto power over projects, as claimed by some opponents of the initiative.
One of the big things that this coastal management program accomplishes is that you actually identify, a project proponent can identify issues early in the process and then go and talk with communities and get their input on how to work towards a successful development project.
The reestablishment of a coastal policy board ultimately doomed efforts by state lawmakers to reauthorize the coastal management program during the past 2 legislative sessions. Some Measure 2 opponents think the legislature should try again, saying the issue is too complicated to be decided by voters. Mike Satry is executive director of the Council of Alaska Producers, a trade group representing large-scale mines and mining projects in the state.
Something as complex as this should really be worked on in the legislative process so that we can develop something that everybody will agree to. But I get very scared about something that supporters admit has problems and simply want it to pass so they can quote-unquote fix it later.
Measure 2 supporters concede it might not be perfect for everyone, and they admit it leans toward giving communities more of a voice in coastal management. Charlotte Brower is mayor of the North Slope Borough, the Sea Party's top financial backer. With exploratory drilling in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas imminent, Brower says the state can't afford to delay restarting the program, and she insists it's not about stopping development.
We are not in a position to stop offshore development or inshore development. It's there. We just need to make sure that we have a seat on the table and talk about this issue that is going to impact our residents. It's coming.
Alaska is the only coastal state without a federally approved coastal management program. The 1972 Coastal Zone Management Act allows states that opt for a program to get some federal funding. Industry opponents of the ballot measure, including the big three oil producers and several mining companies in Alaska, have donated more than $1.5 million to the Vote No on 2 campaign. The Alaska Sea Party has raised just over $204,000, mostly from coastal communities and individuals. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Republican State House incumbent Bill Stoltz has served Matanuska Valley area voters for 10 years. Now Tom Connolly is challenging Stoltz for the District 11 House seat in the upcoming primary, and the Chugiak resident plans to do it without spending a penny. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Representative Bill Stoltz is co-chair of the House Finance Committee, among other positions he's held over the past decade. He was elected to the legislature in 2002 and has had a seat on the Finance Committee since 2003. Since early August, Stoltz has raised more than $75,000 for his campaign. Tom Connolly has raised not a penny. He says he's running because the legislature has failed the state.
Right now, I think we're spending too much time arguing with your oil companies about money coming in, and we're not doing enough to spend a little of that money to create jobs and to help a large number of people get ahead in the state. An example would be the Glen Highway, the Susitna Dam project.
How will Connolly do that?
Well, I'm going to introduce legislation that says we're going to move the Capitol. We're going to get that done. That's a big part of the problem because the people aren't able to influence the government in Juneau. I'm going to introduce a bill that says we're going to build the highway from Anchorage to Wasilla. We're going to build Susitna, and we're going to do it quickly, and we're going to do it with state dollars. We're not going to bond for it. This state's a rich state.
Moving the Capitol away from Juneau is a point Stoltz and Connolly agree on. Bill Stoltz.
Actually, I have introduced that bill, and we've got one bill out of the Finance Committee, which is further than many bills have made. And that would have provided an opportunity for communities to bid on it. It gets mired into some pretty serious politics and a lot of configurations down there. I would love to move the legislature, and I have introduced bills in the past. I just haven't been successful.
Stoltz says the legislative process can be an arduous one. His priorities are more localized, and he spent his time in the House working on neighborhood issues. He represents Chugiak, the Butte, Fairview Loop, and Kinnick River Road.
Areas that didn't have a lot of attention prior to the last decade when I've had the opportunity to serve those folks. Looking forward to finishing the job on a lot of the issues, the transportation and safety issues in Fairview Loop, which I'm proud that we were able to bring attention to those. Continuing problem of erosion in the Matanuska River in the Butte. I don't want to wait until water's up on the highway and before we address those issues.
Incumbent Stoltz is a lifelong Alaskan. Connolly, who hails from Buffalo, New York, has not filed a candidate profile with the State Division of Elections. The two have similar views on some prominent issues like Governor Parnell's oil tax plan. Bill Stoltz.
We're not talking about a political issue. We're talking about an economic issue, which has to go through a political process. We're the only province in the world right now where the oil industry just isn't jumping on oil exploration, but we can make it a more market-friendly approach on taxation.
Connolly says oil companies are taxed too much.
We do tax the oil companies at an exorbitant rate. I don't think there's any other industry that is taxed at that level.
Connolly says he'll push for big projects to create jobs.
Personally, I think we should be looking to the oil industry to see how can we spend some of that money that benefits both the state and the oil companies, be it roads, dams, infrastructure projects.
Stoltz says the reality is that the Mat-Su Borough School District is the biggest employer in the valley.
That's a problem, and that's the strongest force in your economy in the valley. We need to provide real private sector jobs in the valley.
More jobs mean more families, more children, and more education dollars. Stoltz says state education funding is inadequate now.
$1.3 billion for K-12 support. That doesn't count what the legislature puts in for retirement costs, unfunded liabilities, and energy costs. And I think we ought to be doing a lot more in charter schools. We shouldn't be limiting. The most successful model shouldn't be hobbled or shackled, but set to run free.
Connolly says the state's education system is not looking ahead.
The system they have is flawed. I think the state should be spending a fortune on electronics, on more along the lines of online schooling. I think you could integrate the two. We need new ideas.
Stoltz and Connolly will square off in the voting booths on Tuesday. Connolly says it's time to change. Stoltz says representation means a relationship with the voters. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
An Alaska couple associated with a Fairbanks militia group has admitted to buying a gun, silencer, and hand grenades and having maps to federal judges' homes in what prosecutors say was a murder plot that developed from a dispute over paying taxes. Lonnie and Karen Vernon of Salcha appeared in U.S. District Court in Anchorage today to change their pleas and admit to conspiring to murder federal officials. Under the signed plea agreements, Lonnie Vernon will spend from 21 to 27 years in prison, and his wife more than 15 years. The judge set sentencing for November 14th. Lonnie Vernon was a member of the Peacemakers Militia in Fairbanks. He was convicted earlier this year in a separate murder conspiracy plot in the trial of militia leader Schaefer Cox. Vernon's sentence will be for both convictions. An attack in an Anchorage park is being characterized by police as nearly sparking a riot. The incident stems from an assault that took place at William B. Lyons Park in the Mountain View neighborhood on July 28th. It drew dozens to the park and led police to dispatch nearly every officer on duty. However, the incident did not make it into official police reports or make a single headline in the news, and police in the community have kept mum on the incident until now. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
According to state documents, police found a seriously injured man at the park, Anthony Williams. Corey Nea and Jordan Malia were arrested and charged with assault. A district attorney describes the assault during an August 3rd bail hearing for Nea.
This is a fairly serious assault. As you know from the probable cause statement, it involves mutual fighting and then allegations of kicking in the head and whatnot when the victim was down. Yeah, the injuries are fairly serious. The victim sustained a fractured sinus cavity.
Anchorage police officer Derek Schur was working the swing shift patrol on the evening of July 28th around 8 p.m. when he was dispatched to the fight at Lyons Park. When he pulled up to the park, he says this is what he saw.
Other officers were already on the scene. They had several people in custody. There were indications that a violent encounter had occurred. There was blood on the grass and broken bottles and things like that.
As police were arresting Nea and Malia and getting Williams off to medical care, Schur says the crowd began to grow and some got aggressive.
Unfortunately, there were some people who had come across the street from the neighborhood to the west and had arrived in vehicles who wanted to be more than just spectators and wanted to get out on foot and at least verbally confront the police.
Police Chief Mark Mew says the situation escalated into a near riot, but somehow that never made it into official police reports. Tensions have been running high between law enforcement and the Polynesian community since July 9th, after an Anchorage police officer shot and killed Shane Tassi, who was brandishing a stick in the Mountain View neighborhood. The Anchorage Community Police Relations Task Force has been discussing the incident and trying to get the police and the community to work together so as to avoid future incidents. Mew says what happened on July 28th worries him.
People were coming and joining the fracas, and so soon the size of the crowd got way bigger. I've been told perhaps from 25 to 50 people, and they weren't dispersing, and they were getting louder, and the situation was escalating and becoming dangerous. It looked like it was going to erupt into some sort of a riot, and we basically had to bring everybody in.
Chief Mew says nearly every officer on duty was dispatched, somewhere between 25 and 30. Mew says police can use an array of tools to deter rioters. Batons, pepper spray, rubber bullets, tasers, and lethal force is always an option. Officers did not have to use any of those to deter the crowd in Lyons Park. However, he says they're prepared to if necessary. He says he hopes using such methods can be avoided through his work with the task force. So does Lucy Hansen with the Polynesian Association of Alaska. She says Polynesian elders have, up until now, looked to their traditions to handle problems in their community.
What usually happens in our culture, the elders will then go talk to the family of whoever is doing something bad, you know, and talk to them and solve the issue. That's how we take care of things. We iron it out by talking and understanding, and make sure that the kids know that this cannot ever happen again in the future. It is so sorry then and sadly that this happened to those kids, and very sadly that somebody got hurt from this.
Neither Malia nor Nea have a record of committing a crime in Alaska. Hansen says she wants to work with law enforcement, but since the Tassi shooting, many in her community mistrust the police.
I think that relationship was, or that understanding or the trust, you know, was driven away from what happened in a couple months ago or a month ago. And I think that's what we're working toward, to hopefully that to get the understanding from the community and from the police department to work together.
Prosecutors are reviewing the evidence against Malia and Nea. A hearing is scheduled for the end of the month. They both face charges of assault in the second degree, a Class B felony offense. The Anchorage Community Police Relations Task Force, along with the Anchorage Equal Rights Commission, is sponsoring a forum with a representative from the Department of Justice on September 13th. The July 28th incident is sure to be a topic of discussion. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage. APRN Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create 1,500 jobs during the 4 years of construction and spur thousands more after completion by creating access to affordable land for commercial, industrial, and residential use. For facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at alaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.